TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Edward Said on Palestine and the Universality of Human Rights. As I'm preparing this archival program for rebroadcast at the end of June 2020, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to announce his government's annexation of major areas of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank, including the Jordan Valley. Such an act would eliminate whatever possibility remained of creating a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. That had been stated U.S. policy prior to the election of Donald Trump. Netanyahu would be doing this despite vocal opposition from all sectors of Palestinian society, as well as from Arab governments and Israel's Western allies. Even some of Israel's most stalwart supporters in the U.S. are concerned about Israel's decreasing popularity among younger American voters. At times like these, Edward Said's wisdom and authority are desperately missed.
On September 25, 2003, a message made its way around the world. Edward Said, Palestinian-American, world-famous professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, and fearless defender of the Palestinian cause, had died of leukemia in New York City, far from the city of Jerusalem, where he was born in 1935. This is a tribute to Edward Said, a recording of his last major talk on Palestine, recorded by TUC Radio only 7 months before his death. Here is Edward Said before a capacity audience of over 2,000, at the University of California, Berkeley, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq.
I'm incredibly moved and flattered to see all of you here tonight. This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East, and those of the Palestinian people in particular. The United States has already sent a hugely intimidating military force to various Arab and non-Arab countries in the region surrounding Iraq. It is the people of Iraq who stand to suffer the most and whose doubly and triply miserable fate is of the deepest interest to people all over the world. I'm sorry to say that none of this has had the slightest effect on what is a granitic will on the part of a tiny number of members of George Bush's administration to go forward with plans for a war among whose stated imperial intentions is the unilateral wish to bring American-style democracy to Iraq and the Arab world, redrawing maps, overturning governments and states and modes of life on a fantastically wide scale in the process. That all this has very little to do with the enhancements of human rights and a part of the world especially rife with their abuse is patently obvious. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control. The U.S. has at very least asserted its strategic dominance over the center of the world's largest known energy reserves, from the Gulf to the Caspian Sea, and plans to reshape the area by pacifying threats to its dominance in countries like Syria, Iran, and some of the Gulf Emirates. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. Note also that by the end of the decade, China will be importing as much oil as the U.S., and by 2025, the United States will need to import a full 75% of its oil needs from the Gulf region, principally. As against those mighty facts, whether people are prevented from getting an education or from being allowed to move, express themselves, and organize freely without fear, either of intimidation, collective punishment, or straight-out assassination may seem, therefore, like relatively humdrum, if not trivial, issues. but they do pertain with a frightening parallelism to both the people of Palestine and the people of Iraq. In either and both cases, my point here is to assert the universal applicability of human rights to those unfortunate people, given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, forced transfer of population, discrimination on the basis of religion or ethnos, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriations, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. Once big powers start to dream of regime change, a process already begun by the Pearls and Wolfowitzes of this country, there's simply no end in sight. Isn't it outrageous that people of such a dubious caliber actually go on blathering about bringing democracy, modernization, and liberalization to the Middle East? Heaven knows that the area needs it, as so many Arab and Muslim intellectuals and ordinary people have said over and over. But who appointed these characters as agents of progress anyway? And what entitles them to pontificate in so shameless a way when there are already so many injustices and abuses in our own country to be remedied? It's particularly galling that Pearl, about as unqualified a person as it is imaginable to be on any subject except, I'm told, souffles, and any subject touching on democracy and justice should have been an election advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme right-wing government during the 1996-99 period, in which he counseled the right-wing Israeli to scrap any and all peace attempts to annex the West Bank and Gaza and try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. This man and his colleagues now talk about bringing democracy to the Middle East and does so without provoking the slightest objection from any of the media pundits who politely, if not abjectly, quiz him on national television. Colin Powell's speech at the UN, despite its many weaknesses, its plagiarized and manufactured evidence, its confected audio tapes, which to anybody who knows Arabic are completely senseless, as well as its doctored pictures, was correct in one thing. Saddam Hussein's regime has violated numerous human rights and UN resolutions. There could be no arguing about that, and no excuses. But what is so tremendously hypocritical about the official U.S. position in the U.S. is that literally everything Powell has accused the Iraqi Baathis of has been the stock and trade of every Israeli government since 1948. And at no time more flagrantly since the occupation of 1967. Torture, illegal detention, assassination, assaults against civilians with missiles, helicopters and jet fighters, the annexation of territory, the transportation of civilians from one place to another for the purpose of imprisonment, mass killing, as in Qana, Jenin, Sabra and Shatila, to mention only the most obvious, the denial of rights to free passage and unimpeded civilian movement, education, medical aid, the use of civilians for human shields, humiliation, punishment of families, house demolitions on a mass scale, destruction of agricultural land, expropriation of water, illegal settlements, economic pauperization, attacks on hospitals, medical workers and ambulances, the killing of UN personnel, to name only the most outrageous abuses. All these, it should be noted with emphasis, have been carried on with the total, unconditional support of the United States, which has not only supplied Israel with the weapons for such practices and every kind of military and intelligence aid, but has also given Israel upwards of $135 billion in economic aid on a scale that beggars the relative amount per capita spent by our government on its own citizens. This is an unconscionable record to hold against the U.S. and the Secretary of State as its human symbol in particular. As the person in charge of U.S. foreign policy, it's his specific responsibility to uphold the laws of this country and to make sure that the enforcement of human rights and the promotion of freedom is applied uniformly without exception or condition. How he and his co-workers can stand up before the world and righteously sermonize against Iraq while at the same time completely ignoring the ongoing American partnership in human rights abuses with Israel defies credibility. And yet no one in all the justified critiques of the U.S. position that have appeared since Powell made his great U.N. speech has focused on this point. And that is what I want to do this evening. History is made by men and women. And the world we live in is a secular and historical world as a result. History is therefore the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is the divine. Claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the right religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness and that its practices are endorsed by God, I feel it's my moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what is, it claims falsely, to be its national security interests. I have no power. So I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking. By the same token, I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted. The universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and the human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some, of its residents. The point is that no state at all, is entitled legitimately to object to these formulations, and certainly no leader can state unarguably, for example, as George Bush has, that the United States is good and its enemies evil, or as General Sharon has announced, and I quote, "We are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us or has the right to do so." I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are, especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin. Yet the contrast between the immensely powerful and the relatively powerless is not so simple, since the great outcry all over the world against unilateral U.S. war and the felt need by even U.S. government spokespeople to reiterate a general American commitment to democracy and human rights does in fact reveal a profoundly worldly awareness that aside from comfort and convenience, human beings today expect, rightly, to be respected, their requirements for a decent life met, their wish recognized not to be tortured or to be detained unlawfully, their concern for their children and their livelihoods accepted despite the supposedly higher priorities asserted by great power. All these, in theory at least, are rarely challenged head-on and considered to be human entitlements, even if such terrible abstractions as the national interest and national unity are affirmed as superseding individual rights. This unattractive and unacceptable argument certainly now prevails in the US, where education and history, for example, has become a profoundly ideological battle between proponents of a kind of primitive, heroic, white American nationalism and the much more sensible advocates of the multicultural, multiracial realities stressed, for instance, in his work by the prominent historian Howard Zinn. This other American history includes a bitter legacy of domestic slavery, imperial conquest, and terrible class inequality. So the universally accepted widespread conviction that everyone on earth deserves a modicum of human rights has only a symbolic moral power, perhaps too ill-endowed to take on so redoubtable a force as American global reach and all its all too numerous local henchmen and fearsome neoconservative spokespeople who want so-called American values to rule the world, resistance and objections notwithstanding. To speak about Palestinian rights in so skewed a context, therefore, may seem quixotic. And certainly the current impression that Israel and the U.S. have borne all before them in their stubbornly ingrained hostility to Palestinian self-determination reinforces the superficial impression. But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and the establishment of Israel occurred, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, i.e., a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now Palestinians are still stateless, dispossessed, and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. There's no desire on my part to be fetishistically competitive about such a claim, so I won't go on about it any further. But I do want to be able to talk about the visibility not only of the Palestinian presence as victims of injustice and human rights denial, but of the equal force they represent on the world stage of a wrong that must be righted. Note that in all the many different places, conditions, and politics that the approximately 7.5 million Palestinians now live in, as citizens of Israel, as people under military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, as refugees and stateless persons in several Arab countries, as refugees with various acquired nationalities scattered all over the world, and as members of a dispossessed people, Palestinians have developed a moral and political solidarity with each other, nothing less in fact than a national identity, that it has been the goal of Israel to deny, obliterate, and refuse to acknowledge as sovereign. To argue backwards for a moment, let me cite only one recent example of what I mean by denial and a refusal to acknowledge. It was precisely that refusal that flawed the Oslo process from the moment it was undertaken in 1993, alas, with unqualified and unprepared Palestinian representatives delegated to a task which was designed not to restore but to further postpone and deflect the fulfillment of Palestinian aspirations. In this, neither Israel nor the United States was moved by an acknowledgement of past injustices, nor by a spirit of contrition or of reconciliation, with their batteries of legal experts backed by disproportional military weight in both countries and at the same time as more than double the pre-existing number of settlements were being created on Palestinian land and more human rights abused, Israel and the United States divided and subdivided, occupied and ever diminishing bits of Palestinian territory into smaller and less viable units for the unfortunate Palestinian authorities to take over and misrule, all under the misleading, not to say willfully deceptive, rubric of the peace process. The overall plan, beginning in 1948, was to start Israel as if afresh, a state arising from nothing to take its place among the nations. In the affirmation of its renewed millennial identity, Israel managed for quite a while to remove the traces of Palestinian life for the most part, even though, of course, a large number of these traces, who remained as a remnant of people despite the expulsions of 1948, were there as a humbled and scarcely perceptible presence, ruled by military government inside Israel until 1966. Even so apparently innocent a discipline as our archaeology thereafter was complicit in the making over of the land and its markers as if there had never been any Arab Palestinians there. This is chillingly described by Nadia Abulhaj in her recent book, Facts on the Ground, Archaeological Practice and Territorial Self-Fashioning in Israeli Society. Her argument is that in the process of providing Israel with an ancient, objectivized history visible in archaeological evidence, the traces of other, more historically adjunct histories were ignored or simply moved away. What remained became evidence, she says, of a kind of essential Israeliteness, giving the state a pedigree in a long distance past, with the intervening cultures and peoples pushed aside. Moreover, in a trilogy of powerful books entitled A Land Without People, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, and the third one, Imperial Israel and the Palestinians, The Politics of Expansion, 1967 to 2000. The Palestinian-Israeli scholar Noor Masalha has unearthed both the practice and theory of emptying the land of Israel and of its indigenous inhabitants. Much of the pre-state Zionist ideology that mobilized Eastern European communities for the trek to mandatory Palestine was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away, for which the War of 1948 provided field commanders and David Ben-Gurion himself with a rich opportunity. These are amply attested to in the Israeli military archived, as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Masalha himself. Since 1967, the desire to efface or repress what has remained of an institutionalized Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly stated Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against extremist terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of my themes here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like a footprint in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note, however, is that as the resourceful Palestinian-Israeli sociologist Ahmed Saadi has shown in a brilliant piece of historical and social synthesis, the more Israel has unilaterally exerted its considerable force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the Nakba of 1948 as a tremendously potent site of memory. Cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed and disjunctive fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected over time by individuals as objects of memory, such objects as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, embroideries, and so forth. And through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kfar Qasim, Sabra and Shatila, and Jenin events, the significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with a national life that bore and outlived them. I remember writing in 1982 that whenever one of us had an opportunity to speak publicly, there was a felt requirement to start narrating the national collective narrative as if from scratch. No freestanding Palestinian story was available that could place before the world the chronological sequence of dispossession and catastrophic loss that has so disfigured and mutilated contemporary Palestinian life. Such a sequence has been interdicted in all sorts of ways, far too many times, by such things as the carting off by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian archives in Beirut during the 1982 invasion. And only the other day, the Israeli occupation army similarly removed records, computers, hard drives, statistics from Palestinian offices at the Central Bureau of Statistics, the Ministry of Education, and elsewhere in the West Bank. Whether this was meant to put a stop to Palestinian national life just short of full ethnic cleansing, I don't want to speculate here, but that such procedures are of a piece with claims that Israel is fighting for its life and that in occupying and destroying everything possible by tanks, bulldozers, F-16s, and Apache helicopters, it is defending itself against terrorists who happen to have no army or viable means of defense or means of waging war of any description, that seems totally obvious. In any event, the great narrative of Palestinian life hasn't yet been achieved any more than the fulfillment of its logical national aspirations have been fulfilled. Although it seems just as obvious that there is no regression, no flagging among Palestinians everywhere on that inexorable drive. Despite all this, a Palestinian nation in exile has emerged with an unmistakable outline and personality of its own. The vast network of institutions, groups, and collectivities scattered all over the world that sustains the continuity of Palestinian national life is an amazing thing. It has drawn not only on the mobilized energies of Palestinians everywhere, but also on the dazzlingly widespread commitment to them of their friends, allies, and comrades all over the world.
You heard the first part of a 90-minute speech by the late Professor Edward Said. News of his untimely death in September of 2003 shook the world. He is missed as a loved and respected professor of literature, a musicologist and pianist, and an eloquent defender of Palestinian sovereignty. He leaves behind a treasure of writings, including his most influential book, Orientalism, and Culture and Imperialism. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUCRadio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.